From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Kayla DeRoche. Coming up this week, Bristol Bay's Nooshikak King Run wasn't quite as poor as one sonar site determined. The inaccuracy may have been partly due to a design flaw. And Kodiak is preparing to fight back against what it sees as a major threat to its commercial salmon fishery. Then more coming up on this week's Alaska Fisheries Report.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by AK Teach, now enrolling K-12 homeschool students throughout the state of Alaska, creating partnerships that are flexible, family-friendly, and unique to your child. More information is available at AK Teach or at 907-942-0667.
This year, Bristol Bay's Nooshikak King Run struggled a bit, at least by the numbers tallied at the Portage Creek sonar site. The Kings did make their escapement goal range, but the return was lower than Fish and Game was expecting. Now, a postseason aerial survey has confirmed what biologists suspected during the season. The King return was probably quite a bit stronger than the sonar accounted for. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
On July 12th, the Nooshikak King count finally eked past 55,000, the lower end of its escapement goal range. Lee Borden is the assistant area management biologist for Sportfish in Bristol Bay.
We ended up putting past the sonar 56,000. That number, like you said, just barely passes our lower goal of 55,000. We have reason to believe now that the run was closer to an average run than that number would indicate.
In fact, the ADF&G biologists now say they estimate the 2017 escapement was about 90,000 kings, though they do not go back and adjust the data from the sonar site. The change is based largely on data collected from an extensive postseason aerial survey of the Nooshikak King Salmon tributaries. More on that in a moment. But first, for understanding why the count was off, Borden says you can start with the sonar, which was designed to count sockeye, not kings.
The reason it wasn't intended to count kings is the kings run farther out in the river and they run deeper. So if you get a lot of sockeye, they'll be in closer to the sonar and they'll block out some of the kings, so you'll miss some of them on the sonar.
This year, the problem was exacerbated by the second highest number of sockeye ever counted in the river, and also a water level that was the lowest many Nooshikak veterans say they had ever seen.
That leads to the water potentially being a little bit warmer than average. So the kings are looking for cold water, and so they'll run a little deeper than they normally would on a shallow year. And having so many sockeye, a record-breaking year, pushes the kings even farther. So you have those two factors kind of synergistically working together.
Early on, it was difficult to tell if the run was coming in late or small or perhaps both. But by June 23rd, the department reduced the bag limit for Sportfish caught kings to one per day, two per season. Some Sportfish operations complained that the commercial fishery should share the burden and sit out a few tides to let more kings get by. Based purely on the escapement numbers they were looking at, Borden says the department could have put even more restrictions in place. But both he and manager Jason Dye suspected there were more kings in the river than the sonar was counting. Dye believed 2017 was shaping up to be very similar to 1997, another very low water year when postseason surveys showed far more kings than were counted as escapement. The test fishing at the sonar site was picking up more kings in their nets than the sonar suggested were there, and anglers further upriver started saying the season was actually going just fine.
There were days where the sonar would report maybe several hundred fish, and we would have word from fishermen upriver that fishing on that day was good, which leads us to believe there were more fish than the sonar counted.
After the season, Borden was tasked with flying extensive surveys of the spawning grounds. He basically traced every tributary by helicopter, counting individual kings in the river and those that had already spawned and died.
And what we found was comparable to historical averages for the surveys. It was right in line with what we would expect to be in there. So the spawners in the tributaries were about what you'd expect for a normal year. If it was a really low year, we would have seen less fish up in the tributaries.
Borden says the official escapement count of 56,000 will stand, but that the department will note unofficially that closer to 90,000 kings actually made it upriver this year. Subsistence and sports fishermen all seem pleased with the abundance of kings during the season, and the commercial fleet hauled in 32,000, a little bit more than average. all helping affirm the Nooshigak as one of the healthiest king salmon rivers in the state of Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their family. AMSEA at amsea.org or 907-747-3287.
Kodiak is gearing up to oppose what it considers a threat to its fisheries. Last year, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game released a study that found a percentage of Kodiak area sockeye salmon are Cook Inlet fish. Now, some Cook Inlet fishermen want to set caps for sockeye salmon in the Kodiak area. The United Cook Inlet Drift Association is asking the Board of Fisheries to consider an agenda change at its work session next month. If accepted, it would move the consideration of a new Kodiak Area Management Plan up to a sooner date. The next time the Board of Fisheries is scheduled to look over the management plan is 2020. The request is based on findings from a genetic study of sockeye salmon in the western Kodiak management area. According to the study, Cook Inlet sockeye salmon made up roughly 8% of the overall sockeye sampled in 2014, 37% in 2015, and 30% in 2016. United Cook Inlet Drift Association Vice President Eric Hipsch says it throws Cook Inlet sockeye management off if other areas harvest their fish.
You know, all the escapement goals come into question, the brood tables, the management plans, all those things are dependent on using, you know, the best science we have. And when those fish are harvested into another area, then they don't enter. The data is not gathered in this area. We don't know how many fish were being caught, and so the department can't do its job.
In a letter he wrote to the Board of Fisheries in January, Hipsch poses the question of how Kodiak's interception of salmon as they travel into Cook Inlet affects escapement. He says he would hope the board would take a look at the management plan in light of the latest genetic work to minimize the harvest of Cook Inlet and other non-local stocks. Nick Sigalkin, ADF&G's regional supervisor for the Westward region, says they published the study results last year, and they weren't really surprising, at least locally.
The areas where we expected to find most of our major stocks, like sockeye salmon for Karlik, we were finding those in the areas that we expected. We were finding them in the temporal we expected.
The United Cook Inlet Drift Association is requesting sockeye caps through the last week of June and through the month of July. So when Kodiak fishermen have caught the max number of sockeye, all salmon fishing stops. But that's not how the management system currently works in Kodiak, says Sigalkin. Instead, it's based on the health of the run.
So there's sort of a couple things that that concept misses is that it doesn't take into account all the other species that we're targeting, pink salmon, chums, and it doesn't really even look at how we're trying to control escapement.
He says there is one sockeye cap on the North Shelikof Strait. A sockeye salmon management plan there limits harvest of sockeye to account for the last time the issue came up in 1988. Cook Inlet and Kodiak fishermen grappled back then, too, and the Kodiak Salmon Work Group formed as a response. And now the work group is back. They're rallying other Kodiak stakeholders to protest the agenda change that includes local government. At a recent joint work session, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly and the Kodiak City Council looked over a joint letter to the Alaska Board of Fisheries. The letter addresses the damage the fishing limits could cause to the Kodiak economy. Borough Mayor Dan Rohr said the word that comes to mind is catastrophic.
The facts that I've heard in regards to it is devastating for our community, and I don't want to ever be guilty of crying wolf or anything of that nature, but on this one, there are truly catastrophic consequences.
The letter also states the agenda change request fails to meet the Board of Fisheries' three requirements for a change: meaningful new information, conservation concerns, or mistakes in regulation.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Last month, the Alaska Association for Historic Preservation received a $60,000 grant for the NN Cannery History Project from the National Endowment for the Humanities. As KDLG's Avery Lill reports, that is just one step on this project's long road to preserving the history of a Bristol Bay cannery that drew workers from as far away as Italy, Australia, Japan, and the Philippines.
The money from the NEH grant will go toward creating a temporary exhibition curated by the Alaska State Museum to collect, share, and preserve stories and artifacts from the 122-year-old salmon cannery in South Naknek. To create the exhibit, however, the project still needs more grant funding for research. Katie Ringsmith is the project director.
What we did is we got the grant to do the exhibit, but now I need to get the grant money to do the research. So right now, the first step is to just get these last couple grants done and cross our fingers and hope for the best. And if we don't, we just keep applying for more.
The project is in its third year. It's a collaboration between the AAHP, the Alaska State Museum, Tundra Vision, Trident Seafoods, and the Bristol Bay community. Those parties joined forces after Trident Seafoods announced that the cannery was closing in 2015. It had been in continuous operation since 1895. The goal of the project is threefold. Creating an exhibit is one objective. They would also like to record the stories of community members involved at the cannery, and they're in the process of applying for National Historic Register designation. The cannery's story is one that's important to Ringsmith personally. She worked at the cannery, and her father, Gary Johnson, was a longtime superintendent. She also emphasized both the local and international importance of the project.
Oftentimes, you know, when you are talking about the fishing industry, whether it's in school or exhibits, never are these stories mentioned. We're not making these historical connections. So when you want to talk about Alaska and its global immigration story, then a great place to begin is looking at these canneries. Because 100 years ago, you go out onto a dock at Mugup, and you could easily hear 15 to 20 different languages.
Under the NEH grant, the NN Cannery History Project has 3 years to produce the museum exhibit on the cannery. It's one of 29 Creating Humanities Communities grants awarded by the NEH this year. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Every year, a portion of money collected from import tariffs on seafood to the United States has gone toward research and development for U.S. fisheries. The Salenstahl Kennedy Grant Program, which is managed by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, was established in 1980. This year, roughly $10 million from import tariffs will go toward these research grants. Individual awards are between $25,000 and $300,000. Dan Namer is the Salenstahl Kennedy Program Manager.
We actually have four priority areas. And the first is marine aquaculture. We also are looking at projects that are addressing changes to the ecosystem. And then thirdly, we have territorial science, which is actually funds that are going to help support stock assessments for data-poor areas. And then we have, finally, promotion, marketing, and development. And there we're looking for applications that better market the U.S. fishing products.
Namer said that the program is open to a variety of applicants from university and research institutions to unaffiliated individuals. He estimated 50 grants would be awarded this year. The program is accepting applications through October 10th.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. 1-800-992-4960 or online at alaskaboat.com.
And that's all for this week's Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from KDLG's Dave Benninger and Avery Lill in Dillingham. From KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.